Welcome to the Recipes for Residency podcast, where we invite medical doctors from all stages of their training and ask them questions regarding their path to residency and how they were able to successfully match into the specialty of their choosing, and more importantly, the advice they would give to any student trying to match into the same field. My name is Austin Mefford. I'm a third-year medical student at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston, Texas, and I will be your host. Today's guest is Dr. Joseph Sunstein. Dr. Sunstein completed both his medical school and residency training here at UTMB and is now the Urology Residency Program Director and an Associate Professor in Urology here at UTMB. Dr. Sunstein, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Of course. So I usually just like to start the show by asking the guests to just kind of tell the listeners a little bit about their path to medicine and residency.
Okay, great. My path to medicine was, it's almost like it was prescribed, no pun intended there, to bring in a medical term. My dad is a physician, that was, obviously, he was a role model. He remains a role model to this day. That was just sort of always the plan. He was very honest about it. He never influenced me or pushed me into medicine. It can be a difficult life. And you really have to love it if you're gonna survive. So, I had some pretty realistic knowledge of the field coming into it. And so I sort of, that was always the plan, unless something deviated or caused me to deviate from that plan. And so I certainly, went through, my formative years with my eyes wide open, but nothing really drew me in any other direction. It was almost by default, as uninspiring as that may sound. Interestingly enough, once I got into medical school, I thought I was going to become an internist just like him and be a primary care doctor. That was the archetypal, picture in my mind of what being a doctor was. So it wasn't until I got into medical school that I really deviated. Then the deviation occurred. Away from, really what I thought I was going to be doing. Certainly when going, starting medical school, this is absolutely not even close to what I thought my profession, or even my, role, would be. So medicine was sort of by default. Urology, on the other hand, was definitely not. That was the sort of inflection point away from my father. And that certainly hasn't caused any. We joke with each other, obviously, but there's been, he wasn't disappointed, let's put it that way.
Well, good. Did you decide on urology early in your medical school career or until you maybe were doing clerkships and things? When did you decide to deviate, I guess?
Yeah, I was lucky in that two things happened very early in medical school. In fact, as you're a student here, I was a student here. The schedule was the same way back then in 2001, and we started with gross anatomy. And that course, specifically the lab, was the starting point, because I really loved dissecting, and I was never like a hands-on type guy. A lot of surgeons, like orthopedic guys, these are guys that, like, since they were 12, they've been building, working on cars or building boats in their garages and, doing, very hands-on. That was never me. I've always been more of the cerebral type. And so that was something of a revelation to me that, hey, I really like this. I love being elbows in this down in this cadaver, dissecting, exposing things. And so that made me think, well, if I'm enjoying the act of doing this, then what about surgery? Maybe I need to think about surgery. Anatomy is sort of the foundation. I mean, it's the foundation of medicine. That's why we do it first. But it really is foundational in surgery. And so I was like, okay, well, that's interesting, because never had I even considered it. It just was completely foreign to me. So that was one thing that happened. The second thing that happened was that I was exposed very early on to two urologists that were on the faculty here, both of who ended up becoming mentors and eventually colleagues. So they were, there's a course that you're familiar with, Practice of Medicine 1, and part of that course is a small group. So it's like 8 students and one or two usually clinical faculty. So very early on, getting some interaction with clinical faculty and learning clinical skills. And those two faculty from my small group were urologists. I didn't even know urology was a surgical subspecialty. I thought it was, penis doctor,
Sure.
And I wondered why would anybody want to do that, in fact. And so they opened my eyes to the fact that not only is it a surgical subspecialty, but they had clearly drank the Kool-Aid. They were excited about what they did. And that is, depending on your exposure to physicians, my dad was an exception because he loves medicine. But a lot of his colleagues, people I'd talked to, did not love medicine. They did not like their jobs. Or at least they weren't excited about it. And they would add, they would tell me, you should really think long and hard before you go into medicine, because it's not, it's not what you think it is. They didn't seem happy. Well, these two guys, all they wanted to talk about was urology. They were supposed to be teaching us like auscultation and, basic physical exam skills. They're like, you guys can read about that. Let's talk about kidney stones. Let's talk about testicular cancer. Let's talk about the prostate.
Sure.
So that enthusiasm, that that really, made me, again, stop and think, okay, I'm interested in surgery, and then here's two guys that do urology, which I didn't even know, but it's a surgical subspecialty, and they really clearly are passionate about what they do.
Right. Well, and that's interesting that you bring that up, because my roommate actually had you. You were her palm facilitator, and she was saying, I've said I have an interview with Dr. Sunstein, and she was like, oh my gosh, he was my palm facilitator. So, kind of going full circle there. You get to interact with students and show
Absolutely.
Them clinical skills
it
as
really,
well.
It does go full circle, and that's one of so that's POM 2, which is kind of more like what POM 1 small group used to be. Very much clinically oriented, which I think is, kind of one of my strengths or one of my skill sets. But yeah, it does come full circle but those, I should to pay homage to those two urologists who are really, responsible for me being here. One is Dr. Oyuela, still on the faculty here, remains a mentor. And then Dr. Gabriel Rodriguez, who he's now in private practice up the road, but certainly would be remiss not to mention their names and how much their influence, or how much I appreciate what they did for me.
Of course. And you bring up mentorship, and I'm glad you did, because that kind of segues nicely into the next kind of questions I ask. So usually this section of the interview is more so geared to a student who has had that revelation, who knows, okay, well, I'm going to go be a quote-unquote penis doctor, if you will. Mm-hmm. And what advice would you give to someone who's applying to urology but doesn't necessarily, let's just say they're a little apprehensive to reach out to faculty or to reach out to people to find research? How important are those things, and how do you think students should go about that?
Sure. So another person I sort of consider a mentor, not in urology, but just in medicine in general, and especially academics, he once told me that, medicine is just like everything else. And, when it all boils down, it's a people game. It's about people, and how you interact with them. And certainly, the reason I start with that is because I think the most important thing is to start to build personal relationships. And that's obviously, seeking a mentor, and really establishing that relationship. It's sort of like, it's like dating. Like, you have to be pretty, you have to ask that person out.
Sure.
You can't just sort of hang out and have coffee and talk. And then, it has to be, the relationship has to be defined. Sure. So you have to ask, put yourself out there and say, hey, I really am interested in this. Do you think would you mind mentoring me through this process? So establish the relationship, and you don't just have to have one. You can have more than one. But really, early on, building those personal relationships and just, open communication, define the relationship, define that mentor-mentee relationship. What are the goals? What are the expectations from both ends. This is what I expect of you as a mentor, as, and then right back at you, this is what I expect of you as a mentee. I think goes a long way. You know, honesty is important. You may go through that process, build that relationship, and then 6 months later, you're like, you know what? This actually, you know, I think I'm going to head in a different direction. That's okay. I've had, you know, I'd say probably about 50% of the mentees that I have, as far as, you know, folks that are working with me, working towards applying to a urology residency, end up doing something else.
Oh, wow.
And that's okay. You just have to be honest, and don't there. You know, taking a line from like mafia movies, it's not personal; it's business, right? Sure. So, and certainly, you know, just being honest and you know, passing on that information, it's fine. Don't feel like you're going to hurt anybody's feelings. You know, experienced mentors are going to be used to that type of thing happening, and the goal is for a mentor is not necessarily to get somebody into your field; it's to get somebody into a field that they're going to be successful in, that they're going to be happy in. It's really key because, you know, when we talk about burnout in medicine, I think a huge factor is, you know, that person has found the right fit, the right specialty, the right career path. And it's not like there's one. It's not like you have to find, you're looking for a needle in a haystack, because there is, Austin, there is one thing that you were born to do in medicine. It's that one specialty. And if you don't find it, you're going to crash and burn. And
it's the same thing with dating, too. People think there's one person that was put on earth for me. And it's, depending on what you believe, may or not be the case. But
there's a lot of similarities between a marriage and picking a specialty. So you just mentioned one. Like, there is not only one. But at the same time, when you think about happiness and success in life, probably the two most important decisions you're going to make are your partner and what specialty you go into.
Oh,
so very, you know, so there's a lot of similarities. And you talk about, you know, there's a show, right? Married to Medicine. So, you know, it is, these are big life decisions. And again, it's not like it's hard. Like, you, like there's only one thing or one person. But you do want to make sure that you're making, you know, the right decisions. It's right. Going to make things a lot easier for you as you move along.
Well, I like that a lot. It's like, and you, I mean, I guess a lot of aspects of medicine can be related to dating. You said mentoring is like dating. Although with mentors, you said you can have more than one. With dating, mm-hmm. I would recommend against that.
Yeah.
I mean, it depends. I mean, it is the... it is 2021, you know, so we never know.
Again, that goes back to communication. As long as everybody's on the same page and has the same expectations, you, we won't go too deep into the muck here. But
Of course. I like it. So, I mean, and as a mentor, or actually, let me backtrack. You were saying that there's a lot of burnout in medicine, that you were speaking, a lot of people that were advising you when you were growing up were saying, don't go into medicine. Mm-hmm. Would you say that is... mainly in part, that doesn't make sense. Would you say that is in part due to people not finding that specialty that is their calling, and so it contributes to their burnout if they're not actually passionate about it? And would you say that's a common thing in medicine?
I think it's a concern. The AAMC within the last couple of years introduced Careers in Medicine program, which you're probably participating in. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what the motivation for that was, but I really think it boils down to burnout, or part of it at least. And again, you know what determines happiness in your career, and a big one is finding a field that is compatible with your values. You know, the way I describe it is like the practice of medicine, it doesn't matter what specialty you go into. It is often a grind. It's tough. You know, there's all these things. You can go through the whole list of what causes burnout. And it doesn't matter what you do, what specialty, they all have some or many of those things on the list. So that's not what causes burnout, because that's universal. And it's not, you know, there's things we can do, there's things that are within our control as physicians, but there's some things it's just not going to change. So what I think is what prevents burnout, that's what's important. It's not the things that cause burnout. Those are always going to be there. Are there things going on that prevent it? And part of it is your ability to balance. So work-life balance. I'm sure you've heard that before.
A million times.
Part of it is your ability to do healthy things outside of work. Part of it is your support, family, friends, spouse, whatever. And another part of it is, how much does the work make you happy? And that's the key. That's where the specialty, you know, being compatible, I think, comes into it, because you're going to get beaten down by medicine. It's just, it's tough. And so the question is not that. The question is, are you also squeezing out every day or almost every day when you're getting beaten down? Are you also squeezing out those little nuggets of joy, is what I call them, that sort of bring you out of the darkness, so to speak?
Sure.
That you can reflect on at the end of the day, even though everything else was horrible and you had 20 phone calls you had to answer and angry patients, can you reflect on a little nugget of joy almost every day that also came out of that workday? A positive outcome for a patient, you know, whatever. If you can do that, then you're going to battle burnout. But if you can't, if all that bad stuff is there and those little nuggets aren't, it's difficult.
Right. No, and that's really good advice for anyone in medicine, urology, and literally any other specialty. But focusing, kind of narrowing our scope here to what you do every now and then, be a urologist. When you were applying to a urology residency, what steps did you make sure that you had? And let me just preface this by saying that a lot of people on the show have already kind of echoed how residency applications today are a lot different than they were previously. So some of it may be relevant to today, but what were your steps that you made sure you had specific to urology that you wanted to check those boxes? So when you sat in front of a program director, you could say, I have this. Mm-hmm. What were those things?
So, so a lot of things have changed and are continuing to change. I think you might be asking me about the step one at some point. But some things haven't. A lot of things haven't. I think the essentials really haven't. As far as the step one goes, performance on USMLE in general, for competitive specialties, I think it's important. Not necessarily like that you have to have like a phenomenal score, but lower end scores, you know, will exclude you in some. You know, it will make it harder to get your foot in the door. Mm-hmm. For some programs, some programs, they get a ton of applications. There's no way they can look at all of them. And the easiest way to sort of filter initially is to use a USMLE cutoff. Mm-hmm. Now with the pass fail thing, that's going to be a little more challenging. But doing as well as you can on your steps, even if it's pass fail, because the step one, I think is pretty predictive of how you're going to do on the step two, and the step two, until they make that pass fail, is going to be a higher stakes.
Of course.
It's going to be a surrogate for some programs. My program, we're lucky enough, we don't get thousands of applications. So we make a intentional effort to not use cutoffs, because we don't want to, we want to see those diamonds in the rough, so to speak.
Of course.
But bigger programs that get tons of applications are just not going to have the resources to do that. So, you know, performance on the USMLEs, I think, is important for competitive specialties. But certainly, you know, underperformance can make it more of an uphill climb than it otherwise would be.
Of course.
The other thing that I think is important, and I don't think I really did this intentionally, but I did very well. Like, I think my year one and two grades were pretty, you know, they were maybe above average, but they weren't phenomenal. I wasn't, you know, junior AOA or anything like that. But my third year, I killed. I did really, really well. And it's hard to remember. Like, I studied hard for the shelf exams. But it can't just be that. Like, you have to do well in your rotations. You have to, you know, when you, you know, perform well. And that can be very difficult. Knowing what what the expectations are early on, asking for feedback, it can be difficult for attendings to give honest feedback to students or to talk to students who are really struggling. So seeking that out and also being able to pick up on like sort of nonverbal cues, like to know like when you're not cutting the mustard.
Sure.
But performance in the third year clerkships, I think, is very important. It is, you know, the comments that go into those evaluations go into your dean's letter. And that is something that I assume program directors and people looking at applications look at. I certainly do. I think it's one of the more important ways of assessing students. It's certainly, you know, overall grades, like, you know, it's very difficult, to know, you know, from transcript to transcript. It's sometimes hard to tell. Some schools rank students, some don't. Some give very sort of vague descriptions that are a sort of corollary of class rank. Others say, you know, we don't rank our students, all our students are great. So, you know, the only thing that is almost universal, although not completely, some schools are getting away from AOA. But that, you know, it's certainly, you know, it's not a deal breaker. Like even for competitive specialties, like if you're not AOA, I think you're still going to be considered, but it certainly helps, because that might be the only way that somebody looking at your application is going to know, all right, this person's at the top of their class. If you're AOA nominated, at least, you know, so, you know, these are all things that you have some control over at this point. You know, so there's some things you don't have any control over,
right?
You're about to start your third year. You have no control over, I guess you took your step.
We got our step. We got like actual step scores. Yes. So that was good. I mean, it's mm-hmm. obviously good for people above the average. Mm-hmm. They're going, oh, I'm glad we got a number. And then people below the average are like, man, I wish I was next year.
Next year. Yeah.
Right.
But they're just going to kick the can down the road to step two anyway.
Absolutely. So. Absolutely. And we've had a interview with Dr. Shoddy, and we kind of asked her that. And she said that people are going to be placing more emphasis on step two. And then eventually that will go to pass fail. Mm-hmm. And then we'll have to flip a coin to see who gets in where. And you make a point with AOA, and it's going to be interesting to see moving forward, because a lot of schools, their criteria for AOA is different. And so there's not a universal, this student meets XYZ standards, mm-hmm. and so they're AOA. And so program directors even still, and, you know, myself included, a lot of people applying to residency, they go through those spreadsheets and they look at all the, how many publications, how many research experiences, how many volunteer experiences. And a lot of them have percentage of people who match to AOA. So for example, I'm interested in plastic surgery, and only 47% of people who match to plastic surgery are AOA. Mm-hmm. So it's like, well, more than half of the people that matched are not AOA. Right. So, and you alluded to that, mm-hmm. but obviously it helps, of course. And so all good things certainly to keep in mind.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, just, you know, I would say, you know, there's things you have control over, there's things you don't.
Of course.
And the things you don't have control over, you just got to move on. And, you know, they may help you in your decision making. You know, if you have, you know, if you failed two first year classes, then yeah, it's going to be real hard to become a dermatologist. But I mean, you know, but you have no control over that. So if that's your dream, go for it. But just, you know, you just have to be realistic about it. But you can still just absolutely kick butt on your third year rotations. That you still have control over. So yeah, I think, you know, your performance in medical school, I think the third year is the most important. And I think you might have a question about that as well. But, you know. And we can talk about that once we get there, but it's really important. And yeah. If you love medicine, like, it, you know, it's like you finally got, to steal a baseball analogy, like you're finally in the show.
Sure.
Like, this is it. Like you're on the wards, you're seeing patients, and hopefully you're excited about that. You know, if you're not, you know, hopefully you find something that gets you excited. But like I was really excited to finally be, you know, in third year. Like I was ready to get out of the library, you know, out of the books and jump in. But that, you know, there is a cohort of folks who that's really the first time where, again, they get into that people game, mm-hmm. and it can be very challenging. And it happens in every class. There are students who might be very strong academically and they struggle. And they finally, you know, they're like, the school was always really easy, but then third year is just like a challenge.
Absolutely.
And it can be a shock to the system. But it's just like anything else, like that you're here, you're a student, you're here to learn, you're here to work on those skills and interaction and taking a history and working within a team. Those are learned skills just like anything else. It's just some people that's a strength, and some people it's not, and they have to work on it more.
All those budding radiologists are nervous interacting with patients on third year. They just ready for their dark room.
Yeah.
But no, and you're exactly right. And I have kind of learned this even after taking step 2 months ago, I have very quickly kind of been, I guess, abruptly introduced to the people game. You know, it's it, and up until this point, the beauty of medicine really is you can get by so long till this point on grades alone. And then really your third year of medical school, it's okay, well, you may have made a 270 on step in your AOA and blah, 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 blah. But if you don't interact well with people, or you piss everyone off because you're a know-it-all or something, then it's not going to, you're going to go nowhere. And I think that's a rude awakening for a lot of people, and even people that maybe, and it's also a time for people to shine, and they say, well, I haven't always performed at the top of my class, but I'm very good interacting with people, and I like having that face-to-face interaction and with patients and things like that. And so it's a, it's an exciting time. And hopefully, like you said, as much as we get beaten down third year, if we can find that nugget of joy to take away from us, then I think it will be a success. But so just kind of moving a little bit forward, when just asking some miscellaneous questions here, when you are out in the OR, you're on the wards, and you have students rotating on your service, what are some things that you're kind of subconsciously looking for that you, that may either you may really like or may not like so much?
Well, I think you, I mean, you described a few things. Like, you don't, you want to, it's a balance. You don't want to be quiet, fly on the wall, hiding in a corner. You also don't want to, you don't want to be the know-it-all, and you don't want to outshine, you know, your superiors. Like, so there's very much a hierarchy in medicine. It's like the military. So as the medical student, even though you're the only one paying to be there, you are the lowest man, as we say in urology, the lowest man on the scrotum pole.
Of course.
I apologize if that offends anybody, for there's many things offensive about that, but it's a joke. And so you have to, you know, accept that role, even though, again, you are paying, certainly my salary, you're paying the salary of the attendings, or part of it, at least. You're the only one paying to be there. But you are, so, you know, you kind of have to accept that, role. So you don't want to outshine like the intern who just got there and is like stressed out and can't remember what their name is.
And who didn't just take step one, because that, I mean, coming off of step one, I mean, you could ask me any, well, don't, that's not a challenge, but you could ask me a certain number of urological problems, and I may know a little bit more only because I just had to 2 months ago.
Yeah. So ask, so be prepared to be asked questions, answer questions when asked directly, don't answer questions when other people are asked, unless, you know, when you know, there's, again, this is a not politically correct term, but there's a term called pimping. And again, if I offend anybody by that, I'm sorry, but that's what it's called. But it's basically like, you know, lining people up and asking questions. And it is a very common, albeit probably not all that useful, educational tool. It's more of a, you know, assessing people's ability to answer questions on the spot.
Scare
tactic. It's also trying to figure out what is this person's background knowledge about this particular problem. And if the knowledge isn't there, then, you know, so the stick is the pimping. The carrot is, if you get it wrong, yes, you're publicly humiliated. Hopefully, you know, not really, but that's okay. You don't have to know all the answers. That's why you're a medical student or a resident or an attending. That's why it's called the practice of medicine. But anyway, so don't, you know, you shouldn't get too beat up about not knowing the answer. But if somebody's going to do that, the stick of getting put on the spot, the carrot is that the knowledge will be passed on. So if somebody's asking those questions, they should also be prepared to provide the answer. So it is a time, I don't want to say honored, but it is definitely a traditional means of teaching, you know, in the clinical setting is questioning.
I guess, sure.
The more politically correct term.
For sure. No.
But when, you know, answer questions when you're asked the question, not when the intern or the other, or the fourth year or the other third year is asked. Give people a chance to, you know, to answer questions. Again, it's just all, you know, treat others like you'd want to be treated. You know, that's cliche. But, you know, that it holds very true. The other thing I would say about like what I want to see in a student on a clinical rotation is I want to see, and this is kind of, you know, this is how I tried to approach rotations. Consider yourself a part of the team. Like not, you're not a guest, you're not a bystander or an observer. You are there to participate in the activities of that team. And the activities of that team are generally going to be clinical care. So you're there to help take care of patients and learn. But they happen. They need to happen together. It's not like one or the other. It's not like, oh, well, I'm a student. I shouldn't have to, you know, run that order down to, you know, radiology. Not that we have to do that anymore, because that's not educational. Well, you know what? I mean, there's a lot of things that aren't educational, but part of it is learning to do the work of patient care. It's not all educational. It's not like, you know, what's his name, Dr. House, who like, you know, Sherlock Holmes and figures it out and sits in a room and thinks about things. There's active work that needs to be done. Jump in there, get knee deep in or elbow deep in with the residents and do the work. Because when you do that, good things happen. You're around when unplanned things happen, consults, emergencies, running off to the OR to do something. You're there because you're with the team. Versus the student who, you know, goes on rounds, gets their assigned case for the day, and then the rest of the time they're nowhere to be found. They're studying, you know. You can, you know, study later, you know, during the day, like when the work is happening, do the work. That's the best way to learn. It's the best way. So implant yourself into that team as a part of the team. You know, I think that to me is what I'm looking for in a student. I don't want to have to look for a student. I want to know that, oh, Austin, hey, there you are. Let's go check out this consult, or let's go do this case, or, and let me show you the x-rays. And this is why this is kind of cool. Nobody's going to like page you to come do that. You have to be there.
Of course. And I've been told there is a line though, because sometimes as medical students, we feel, I mean, we use the term shadowing, and it's mm-hmm. a very accurate term, but sometimes we will shadow the doctors to the restroom or shadow mm-hmm. them to the vending machine. And it's mm-hmm. like, and sometimes we're like, okay, well, as a student, you want to be active, you want to be productive, but it's kind of embarrassing. Like if you're going yeah. to the restroom and I'm following you in there and you're like, okay, like you don't, yeah, I can do this myself.
It happens all the time though.
I can do it myself.
It happens all the time. So, and yeah, and that, so it's, you know, obviously depends on the person, but it happens all the time. I wouldn't worry about it too much. Again, you're the only ones paying to be here. So don't forget that. Even though you're the low person, on the rung, it all comes down to, again, you know, you picking up on nonverbal cues. You can tell if you're being a little too much of a mosquito buzzing in somebody's ear. So you just back off a little bit.
Right.
Ask for feedback. But again, just take cues from other people, you know, what other people are doing. But I think that's probably less of a concern than you might think.
And be friends with the residents is what Absolutely. I've always been told from everybody.
Yeah. So again, it's hierarchy, right? So the closest to you in rank is going to, one, rely on your fourth year medical students if they're around, because they're a great resource. Mm-hmm. I know my first rotation, like I just followed my fourth year around for like a week and just to know where things were.
Right.
What's the quickest way to get to the ER? But then the residents, and they can be, you know, when you talk about getting into residency, they can be a phenomenal resource. They're the ones, like the interns especially, they just did it. So they have the most sort of contemporary insight of anybody you're going to talk to. And they're the closest to you as far as their, you know, experience and their knowledge. And so they're a great resource. They can also be if you're interested, you know, and you're helping them out, you're helping do the scut. They may be throwing research projects at you like, hey, you should help me write this paper, you know. So there's a quid pro quo there. You know, again, it's a people game. You scratch my back, I'm going to scratch yours kind of thing. The residents are phenomenal resources. And they're also like they tend to be very good teachers, too. They want to show off their knowledge. So, you know, as they get more confident and more experienced, you know, this is the higher level residents, upper level residents, a lot of them are excellent teachers. And they know a lot because they're studying for their tests and, you know, they're the most up to date and the most excited about the material. So, and they tend to be, you know, they're a little more approachable. They're closer in age. They're, you know, they're not high up on their pedestals like some of the faculty.
No, absolutely. I refuse to send LOL in a text message to a faculty member, but I will if it's a resident, because okay. I feel that yeah. they are more culturally woke than the majority of the faculty.
Absolutely. They're much closer as far as, you know, a peer, somebody who's a similar age, you know, they're much more closer as far as peer group goes.
Of course.
And yeah, some attendings, they'll have no idea what, you know, they may not even know how to text. I don't know. So.
Oh, no. We've interviewed Dr. Courtney Townsend on the show, and I mean, as much of a relic as he is, mm-hmm. he did Zoom very well. I was mm-hmm. impressed, and we commended him on that. Very impressed, but yeah. not, they're not all like that.
Dr. Townsend has a great head on his shoulders. I'm not sure how he would respond to an LOL though.
No, I guess there's only one way to find out.
Yeah.
But
I'll let you do that.
Yeah. You can let me do that. He was my mentor for Palm. So maybe that's already been done, but I just kind of wanted to comment on what you were talking about with the third year. And this is actually news to me, and, you know, and this is one of the benefits I get from doing these podcasts, because I get to interact with you guys. And not only do we get to broadcast it to the listeners, but I mean, I get a little something out of it as well, being able to talk to you guys and learn. And I kind of had that question in the back of my mind of like, well, when do I study? Because, you know, you talk to some medical students and they say, oh, well, I study after I'm done with my things from this hour, or whatever. I go into a corner or a hole and I study. But I mean, good to know that it's like whenever people are in the hospital, whenever the attendings and the residents are there rounding, or in the wards, be there and be present, because things are going to happen and it may be good learning opportunities for you. And then you can try to study when you get home, if you're not dead by then. But good advice all around. And I mean, and we know it's going to be a grind. It's always a grind. And what you're saying is on the totem pole, or the scrotum pole, if you will, everybody before us has done it. Mm-hmm. And so it's doable. You survived. You're here. So it's definitely not something that is unattainable for mm-hmm. sure. So just a couple more questions to kind of wrap things up here. Whenever you are sitting in the room with interviewees, and I doubt anybody applying to UTMB Urology is listening right now. And if they are, then either they get a leg up on the competition or whatever. But
this is going on Twitter, so.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, it's there you very go. Possible.
Okay, for sure, for sure.
I didn't be listening at some point.
Didn't know you're a big Twitter guy.
I really want to do. I'm a what's the word? The word I'm looking for.
You savvy, Twitter savvy?
No, I'm not. That's, you know, the exact opposite. I'm a somewhat resistant Twitter guy.
Oh, okay. I got you.
We can go, you know, I don't know if we want to go off on a social media tangent, but it is somewhat necessary in my line of work, especially, you know, as we went to sort of virtual everything last year. So my boss, my division chair, very gently told me that I needed to get on Twitter. And so I have, you know, slowly worked my way in. But yeah, I mean, I think it has value.
And you post selfies every week?
Yeah, no. You know, it helps. It helps get the word out and, you know, let, you know, if people can't come and visit, there has to be ways that they can get to know what we're about. And it can help with that.
Of
I don't
course.
Think it's as wonderful as some people think. You know, I don't want to go off on a tangent about social media, but I think I'm kind of old school as it goes. But that being said, yes, this will go on Twitter. So okay. I think it'll help both of us.
Well, let me just kind of peg off of what you were saying there. What do you think about potential interviewees or potential applicants contacting faculty at any program on social media? What do you feel about that? Or do you think that's kind of taboo?
I think it depends on the context. So most, if that person is using their social media account on a professional level, which is what I do. So like when I tweet stuff, it's about work. It's mostly to promote our program. Absolutely. Like that's the whole point. Yeah, that's completely appropriate. If it's like their personal account and they're, you know, they're not posting anything about work, that would be a little weird.
Sure.
So, you know, just again, you know, cues and boundaries and be aware of that. But no, if people are talking about work on Twitter, it's because they want you to read their stuff. They want exposure to their program and they want you to reach out to them. So I would not hesitate. That being said, just a little like, you know, all, you know, the match does have some rules about communication, and specifically for urology, communication after an interview. So once you interview with a program, that should be the end of any communication, certainly from the program to the applicant. In fact, it is prohibited. We would not even be allowed to send a thank you note or a, hey, thanks for interviewing, or a, hey, we really liked you. You should really consider our program. That is against the rules. Wow. So once the interview day is over, that's it as far as programs reaching out to applicants. Now, applicants can certainly reach out to programs and say, hey, thanks for interviewing me, blah, blah, blah. It doesn't make any difference, but you can do it. But things like, oh, can I come for a visit, or can I, you know, second look, or, hey, I'm really interested in the program, I'm going to match you highly. Like those are not, you know, those are not considered appropriate. It's more like if an applicant's going to reach out to a program after an interview via email, Twitter, whatever, you know, a thank you note is fine, but it shouldn't be anything about, you know, I really enjoyed it, I'm going to rank you highly, those kinds of things. One, nobody believes that anyway. It may come off as a little unprofessional. And those boundaries are very well delineated. I mean, it's not like it's not an unwritten rule. Like the urology has its own match, so they're very good about communicating mm-hmm. with the programs as well as the applicants.
Okay.
So after you interview at a program, I would limit communication. For urology, whether it's different for other programs, I don't know, but you know, the match is supposed to kind of keep things on a level playing field. Mm-hmm. And you know, communicating outside of that, can certainly reek of unfairness.
Okay. And so let me ask you this. I lied when I said two more questions. I just have a couple more. So what do you think about, or I guess a better question would be, how do you look at people who dual apply? So urology is a very competitive mm-hmm. surgical subspecialty. People who dual apply gen surg and urology, mm-hmm. what do you think about that?
I think from the applicant side, it's challenging. It's a lot of work because if you're going to do it, you need to have two separate applications. Like, and that's letters of rec, personal statement, like, you know, if you're going to do it, it has to be two separate. Otherwise, yeah, it looks a little weird. And you know, it's just not going to be received very well when your letter of recommendation, if I'm reading a letter of recommendation as a urologist and it's from a general surgeon who says, yeah, I think this person's gonna be a great general surgeon. Like that just doesn't, you know, I don't care if it's from a general surgeon. It says, man, I wish this person would do general surgery, but I couldn't get them to do general surgery because they want to do urology and they're going to be a great urologist. That's okay. But it's when clearly the letter was written for a different field. That's not great. But do I look, you know, does it make any difference to me if somebody's either not sure or they have a backup plan? Sure, go for it. But if you're going to do it, you have to two separate, completely separate applications. You can't kind of blend them together.
If you're going to do it, you better do it the right way.
Yeah.
But program directors cannot see if someone technically dual applied unless they dual apply to the same institution. Correct.
Yeah, and even then, I don't know if they would see it. And I wouldn't be necessarily, I mean, it's not necessarily something you would have to advertise, but certainly if it somehow comes out, I mean, I don't think it's anything you need to hide.
Okay.
That's personally, I mean, some people may frown upon it. You know, I would just say if you're going to do it, have two separate everything. And it's not, you don't even necessarily have to have different letter writers. You just have to, the letter writers have to know that, hey, I need a letter for surgery and I need a letter for urology. Now, that being said, for, you know, urology is a very small world and letters of rec are very important. And there's two kinds of letter. Well, there's three kinds of letters. And 95% of the letters are one kind, which is somewhat generic. It's like, yeah, I know this person, they're great, they did a great job, they've done, and then they kind of list off some things on their CV, and yeah, I think this person would be great, we're certainly going to consider them for our program. That's most letters of recommendation. And then there's a very small, but it comes from somebody who you know, because urology is small, and if you don't know the person writing it, you certainly know who they are. For them, I mean, you know, or where they're coming from, because you know your strongest letters are going to be in that specialty, academic, you know, person writing it. Definitely, most of your letters should be, you know, in anything you do come from that. The other two letters are the ones that can actually make, you know, that really sway in one direction or the other. So very rarely you get one that's just annihilates the person, like this person sucks. Very rarely, but I've seen it. And you're just, you know, if that happens, you're dead in the water. Like, no, assuming everybody's reading the letters, which they should be, and doing their homework, you're not going to, you know, you're not going to be successful if you, because it's so, it's not common, but if it happens, like you're screwed. So it's important to ask a letter writer, not will you write me a letter of recommendation, but would you be comfortable writing a positive letter of recommendation for me? And if that person says no, you might want to seek some feedback because you may have some soul searching to do. But don't, that should not be somebody that you have write a letter for. You want to say, you know, can, will you write a good letter for me? So going back to the three types, the third type is a glowing letter of recommendation. And it's not only that it's very positive, but it's that there's some, you know, this goes back to those personal relationships that, like, you know, I've known this person since this time. Here, like, let me tell you a couple things that really make them great. And, you know, if this person came here, I would be like ecstatic. So, you know, those letters really have a lot, you know, a lot to, you know, drive somebody's application in the right direction. But those are the three types of letters. Most of them are in the middle. You could say the same thing about personal statements. Most of them are generic. You know, I want to be a urologist because I, you know, blah, blah, blah. Some, very few are bad, and it's usually not like content because it's just the generic content, but like there's typos or, you know, grammatical errors, things like that. So you can avoid that by just making sure like five people read your personal statement. Just, you know, very good editing. And then there's, and again, there's those few that really like where somebody has a unique story, something where they, that it just makes them stand out where it's like, man, I can't wait to talk to this person. I want to hear more about this. So anything, and it doesn't even have to do with urology. I mean, it just can be life, like, you know, what, you know, experiences, unique experiences, a unique background, dealing with adversity, you know, beating the odds, folks who, you know, were collegiate athletes or they were in the Olympic trial. You know, these are things that, you know, anything that makes you stand out. If you have that unique story, a lot of people don't. It's okay. I didn't have anything like that. A lot of people don't. But if you do, get that into your personal statement, you know, use that to your advantage.
Yeah. And I mean, we've had, I don't know if I've actually specifically asked about personal statements on the show, which is good. I'm going to write that down and remember it going forward. But I've heard just from different faculty and residents and things, differing opinions on the personal statement. Mm-hmm. Some people say, don't try too hard. Like, mm-hmm. don't say something really outlandish because you think it's a really great story and then it's really cheesy. Mm-hmm. But then also, you wouldn't, I mean, unless it's just the case, but I mean, if I'm reading a personal statement to urology and someone's like, man, I've always wanted to be a urologist because I had a kidney stone. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's kind of boring. Yeah. You know what I mean?
It's, you know, again, if you have like, but certainly I've had a lot of personal statements where they are testicular cancer survivors.
Sure.
It's the right age group. That's not uncommon. I think that's very relevant, especially if it's true. You know, it's like, you know, this really influenced me and I feel like I have a lot of empathy now to treat those patients. And that's what I want to do. You know, I think that's a valid thing. But yeah, kidney stone, yeah, you know. But it depends. But again, the vast majority of personal statements are kind of like letters. They're not really going to help you. Just make sure they don't hurt you.
Of course.
That's okay. But again, if you have something, you know, that you feel like you can really leverage, definitely put it in there.
Okay, so now I actually am, this is the last question, mm-hmm. I promise. So as far as resources are concerned, people interested in urology, people are applying to urology, what resources would you like them to know about?
So a lot of stuff we already talked about, the faculty and the residents at your program are your most useful resource. And you should definitely avail yourselves of them. Again, the faculty especially, that's what they're there for. They work for you. As a medical student,
you pay them.
You pay their salary. It's mm-hmm. part of it. You know, avail yourself of their services, their knowledge. The residents, again, more of a peer group to give you some more, you know, a little bit more perspective as to what residency is like, because that's important to consider. Because just because it, you know, yeah, it's just 5 years, you can do anything for 5 years. That's not true. You don't want to be miserable in residency, you know, it's not just a means to an end. It should be a great experience, hopefully it is if you pick the right program and you pick the right field. Then there is, you know, social media. So again, like Twitter is kind of the de facto social media platform for urology, and a lot of academic medicine is what I gather. So get on Twitter, make sure you're not, you know, that you're appropriate, you know, be professional, and follow programs and follow program directors, and you, you know, and that can give you a little flavor of maybe of the personality and what they're up to and things like that. There's lots of different websites, Euroresidency, urologymatch.com. The AUA website has a whole section for medical students related to education as well as to the match. And then the Society of Academic Urologists is the governing body of academic urology, and they actually run the match for the AUA. So that's a good resource as well. And I can certainly get you links, you know, to all those things, if you want to put them, you know, on the
web show page. Notes. Yes.
Yeah. As far as other resources, you know, I think that's, it's, I mean, I think the most important, again, are those people that you can make personal relationships with. So getting a mentor, making sure that the group, you know, at your institution knows who you are, knows you're interested. And, you know, if you have those people skills, and you're willing to work hard, you're going to get opportunities. When you get an opportunity, follow through. Ask questions, meet deadlines, and then you're going to get more opportunities.
Of course. Well, like you said, I can find those links and we can put them in the show notes so you can just click on it and it'll take you straight to that site. But I think that's all the questions that we have. Thank you so much to Dr. Sunstein for coming on the show today.
Absolutely. It was
wasn't
pleasure.
Too bad, was it?
It was great.
It was great?
Yeah.
Well, I can link our emails in the show notes as well. If people have any questions, they can email us. Or if you want to follow Dr. Sunstein on Twitter and look at his selfies that he posts every day.
Absolutely.
You can do that as well too. So thank you guys so much, and stay tuned for more ingredients on the Recipe for Residency podcast.